Everyone, welcome to another edition of Swarm Chatter Live. Tonight, we're going to be joined by Joshua Toplitzky, who's a pro assistant professor of history at Stony Brook University, regarding his book, Prince of the Press, which I have over here, on Rav David Oppenheim, who was the chief rabbi of Prague, amongst other things, and his library, which is, let him talk about it. It's probably the greatest collection, I guess, of Jewish books, manuscripts, which is now housed in Oxford University. So let's see if we can get him when he gets on. And we'll start that. So I'll let him talk about it. The book was really good. I read it. I enjoyed it. I assume people tuning in will have read it or heard of it. It's available from Yale University Press. I'll obviously link to it after the show in response to this. I will put up a link. There we go. Join now. So once Josh joins, we'll begin to discuss about the book and Rav David Oppenheim. Actually, it was in a podcast. It seems like he did a while ago, but it just got posted recently. I can link to that as well. That'll address some other aspects of the book and his research that I'm not planning on getting into, planning on being a little different. So in a way, it's good for me because if you want to hit on those aspects, which we'll see what they are, you can just refer you there and not here. Let's see if he's able to join in here. There we go. Okay, can you hear me? I can. You are on. Thank you
All
very
right.
much. Perfect. Thank you very much for coming on. So why don't we
Thanks
begin
for
by
coming.
telling everyone a bit about yourself and your background. Start off that way.
Bit about myself. Sure. I'm a native of Toronto. I've been living in New York City for a long time. I was an undergraduate at Yeshiva University, and I did my PhD at NYU at New York University. For 2 lucky years of my life, I lived in Oxford, where I was a walk from the Bodleian Library, and that's the place that the Oppenheim collection is today. For 2 glorious years, I used to spend from morning until the library would close. In those days, the library didn't close until 10 o'clock at night. I would stay until the librarians would ring the bell at 10 o'clock at night to kick us out of the library, spending all of my time with the Oppenheim collection. Nowadays, I teach at Stony Brook University. I teach Jewish history there. I try to get around. I've been around to a couple of other universities here and there, but my home university is at Stony Brook, and that's my professional profile.
Almost. So you were an expert for 2 years. You were a student there, or
I was
just.
not. It was after I had finished my PhD. I'll tell you just like I think this is an okay story to tell. When I interviewed there, they had a position where they wanted somebody to come and do Jewish history. And they said to me, "Do you know?" And I talked to them a bit about, I wrote a dissertation about Oppenheim. And then, so the book that we're going to talk about today is the product of many years of research, many years of thinking about it. I had already written my PhD about Oppenheim, and I was getting ready to turn it into a book. And they said to me, "Do you know what you'd like to look at when, if you were to receive this position to come to Oxford?" And I said to the committee, "I can tell you the call numbers of the first books that I would like to look at." And they later told me that it was at that point in the interview that they felt that they had the right match between the person and the position.
Oh, wow.
It was just luck. It was just good mazel that they were looking for somebody, and I was looking for a very Oxford thing right then.
Right. So I guess you actually held these a lot of these manuscripts and these books that we're going to speak about, I guess, for 2 years then.
That's I got to hold them in my own hands. I even there was a time when you could even go down into the stacks. The Bodleian Library, you have to call books up if you want to see them. But there was a time if the librarians trusted you enough, they would take you down into the stacks and allow you to walk through and get to see how much space Oppenheim's library takes up, just to get a sense of just how very large it is.
Wow. Okay, so let's jump into it. What attracted you? Obviously, you said you wrote a PhD and then a book and dubbed it up. And what attracted you to him?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question. Oppenheim wasn't the first thing that I thought about. I've always been very excited, or ever since getting interested in Jewish history, I've been very excited in the period right before the modern. I've been excited about the years between the 16th to the 18th centuries. I think it's a very dynamic, exciting time in Jewish history. And so I fumbled around for a while to try to figure out what subject or topic would be a good one for me. Anybody who has tried to go to graduate school and has tried to write a doctorate knows that it's full of all kinds of false starts. You get really excited about something, you get a big idea, and then it turns out that somebody else has had your idea already. Or you get a really big idea and you're certain you're going to ask brilliant questions, but there's no material for you to answer the questions that you have. I had a couple of those false starts and stops, and then came to I did what any good student should do is I read. I read and I read, and I kept on seeing Oppenheim cropping up in whether it was the Sfarim that I looked at, or documents that I was reading, or equally importantly, the work that other historians had done. Somebody would stop by Oppenheim's house, or somebody would check something in Oppenheim's library. And it occurred to me that it might be really interesting to think about what the history of this period would look like if, instead of letting Oppenheim be in the footnotes and in the Haskamas, if we put him at center stage and got to see a map of European Jewish life from his perspective, or using him as the vehicle to look at European Jewish life instead of just somebody who's off on the sidelines. So that's how I found him, and then increasingly became just fascinated by the world of materials that was associated with this man. Oppenheim is most famous for his collection of books, but in the archives in Prague, there are hundreds of pages about negotiations over making him chief rabbi. Oppenheim himself saved all of these documents that are in the Jewish archives in Prague, not the state archives in Prague, that give us a window into community life. So when you look at Oppenheim, you can see all kinds of life of Jews at this time, and in particular of the life of the Jews of Prague, which is full of fascinating stories that I think the world has still not heard enough of. So I think Oppenheim is a great way to guide us into the world of books, the world of learning, Jewish Prague, and beyond.
Wow, fascinating. So, start off with a brief biography of David Oppenheim.
Okay. So here's in a nutshell, here is the life of Rav David Oppenheim. He was born in the year 1664 and died in the year 1736, which is a relatively long life for that time period. He was born in Western Germany in Worms, which is a venerable community. It's part of the Shum communities, the Kehilot Shum, that have lasted, have been part of sort of the cradle of Ashkenaz since the Middle Ages. He was born into an extremely wealthy family of court Jews. And in his youth, the conveniences of the court Jews and his family values about caring about learning guided him through a series of Talmud and mentor relationships that brought him into contact with some of the greatest lights of his generation. We think that he was tutored at home by Yair Chaim Bachrach, for example, the Chavos Yair. In his teen years, he traveled around through Western Germany to the major yeshivas of his time. Just to give you a bit of context about the time, where basically he was born about 15 years after Tachvatat. So we're talking about years where there had been something of a decline of the Polish yeshivas, and his learning had happened relatively close to home. This was a major change in the middle of the 17th century. In the years after the Chmelnytsky massacres, the Polish yeshivas declined for a bit, and we see an uptick in the stature of the Western Ashkenazic yeshivas. So Oppenheim learned in a number of these places, and then Well, he was still a pretty young man, but around the age of 25, he got his first major rabbinic position in Moravia, which is in the eastern half of the Czech Republic. Not a lot of people know where Moravia is these days, but it's in the Czech Republic, where he slowly but surely, actually quite quickly, rose to become the chief rabbi of all of the Jewish communities of Moravia. And by the year 1703, he was named chief rabbi of Prague. It was a position that he held, that he shared. He wasn't the sole chief rabbi of Prague. He was the co-chief rabbi, and we're gonna chat about that a little bit later, I hope. I know you've got a question waiting for me on that. But he held that position without interruption for the next 33 years of his life until his death in 1736. Now, there's a lot more to say because to posterity, Oppenheim is less known for his time in Prague and much more known for this amazing monument that he has left behind, which is his magnificent collection of books, a library that numbered, it's hard to count. It depends how you choose to count books, but so well, conventionally we number the collection as being about 4,500 books. And another 1,000 manuscripts. And we can choose to call it more. We can choose to call it less. Do you call a book everything that's in one binding or all of the individual titles? Do you count all the duplicates he has or not? These are different questions. I'm not sure there's different nafkaminas between all of those, but by and large, he had about 4,500 books and approximately 1,000 manuscripts. And that's what made him an extremely famous person in his own time. Although in many sectors of Jewish history, his story has kind of been lost or buried or not really paid attention to as much.
Right, I was going to say his successor, I don't know if it was his immediate successor, a little bit after, the Nadav Yehuda was much more well known as the chief
Much,
rabbi of Prague.
much more. When I tell people I'm interested in the Jews of Prague, they say, "Oh, the Maharal." I say, "No, a little bit later." They say, "Oh, the Nadav Yehuda." I said, "Well, actually, a little bit earlier than that."
Right.
And then I say, "David Oppenheim," and they say, "Okay." And that's usually where the conversation ends. But I'm hoping that with this book, and your audience already knows a lot about this, but I'm hoping with this book to put David Oppenheim back on the map of part of the longer history of Jewish life in Prague. But also, I should say there's something else that I wanted to do in this book when I was telling Oppenheim's story, and that was I wanted to use his library to not only let the story of the Jews of Prague be about the five or six Rabbanim that you can mention, so not just about the Maharal to the Nadav Yehuda, but to also think not just about David Ganz or others in between, the Shlach or people like that, but to also think about all of the thousands, literally thousands of other Jews and non-Jews who lived in Prague, and think about how they made up this total ecosystem together. Because the yeshivas of Prague, but also the regular Jewish houses of Prague, in many ways touched and can be viewed through Oppenheim's library. We see men and women, we see lamdanim and servants, we can see a whole world of people as they come together through the pages and volumes of this library.
Right. So to focus a little bit more on him before we get more into the library and the book,
Sure.
you mentioned the book, though you did discuss obviously a lot of these biographical details. How is it that he came to be chief rabbi of Prague? Obviously, that was his the bulk of his career was there. That's what he is most well known for. How
Yeah.
did that come about?
Good question. Very good question. I think that two important factors combined for him to become chief rabbi of Prague. The first was his training, was his learning, and the second was his yichus. And I think those really are inseparable one from the other. As I already said, throughout the 1680s, for example, Oppenheim learnt with all of the greats, Gershon Ashkenazi and Metz, Yarchaim Bachrach, and others of that ilk. But he also had really, really influential and powerful relatives. Oppenheim's uncles were and his father's-in-law were all court Jews. And this is a really important part of the story. I'm so glad that you asked, how did he become chief rabbi? Because in much of Jewish history during this period, chief rabbi was as much a political position as it was a position of learning. How Jews fared depended, not only on their relationship to books and Torah, but also on their relationship to power and politics and all kinds of this worldly things. And Oppenheim's uncle, Samuel Oppenheimer, is usually how he's referred to, was one of the most famous, if not the most famous, court Jew of his era. He was the personal court Jew to the emperor in Vienna. And Vienna was the capital of this sprawling Habsburg monarchy, and Prague was one of the cities under its domains.
I want to just jump in for a second. For people that might be listening or people that might not know, could you just explain what is a court Jew? My
Thank
finger
you.
may not know what that is.
Thanks for reminding me. Thank you. You're a good interviewer. You're a good interviewer. Court Jews are this kind of funny thing that belonged to really kind of a century between the years 1650 and 1750 was their heyday. They were kind of private bankers and lenders to princes and kings, especially in Germany. And I'm a little hesitant to call it Germany. I like to call it the German lands because Germany, as we know it, as a centralized thing, is really a late 19th century creation. In the late Middle Ages and the early modern period, there were hundreds of little principalities. And the thing about a little principality is it needs smaller loans. It doesn't need to pay for its wars or its building projects by taxing all of its inhabitants, although it still does tax them, but it can get on with one or two very hefty lenders. And the years before Oppenheim was born were 30 years of war, aptly called the 30 Years' War, which had destroyed a lot of the banking systems of these German lands. And so when princes and kings and dukes wanted to rebuild, they needed somebody to finance them. And often Jews were prepared to take that risk. It's not because Jews were the wealthiest people in Europe. That's certainly not the case. First of all, we're only talking about a tiny, tiny percentage of the total Jewish population, but some wealthy Jews were prepared to take on that economic risk. And that catapulted them into positions of political influence. They became part of the cabinets of princes and kings, so that there was actually an official German word, a Hofjude, it was usually called. A court Jew was a part of the cabinet of the emperor in Vienna and lots of other princes, kings, electors, and dukes in other parts of Germany.
So, owing to this, that's really how he was connected, so he was able to get his position in Prague.
So not to say that he was not qualified, he certainly was, but he certainly needed the combination of both of these things. How do we know this? There's a bit of a smoking gun for something like this. When Oppenheim was offered the position of chief rabbi of Prague, he wrote a beautiful flowing letter of thanks to the basically to the Kehillah of Prague for naming him chief rabbi, and he signed it from his uncle's house in Vienna. Now, okay, Dafke, he was in his uncle's house in Vienna at the time, but I think the fact that he chose to leave details like that, the fact that he chose to put those out in the open, was a way that he regularly reminded people that he was a Macher, that he was at once somebody who knew things, but he was also somebody who knew people. And both of those were important ingredients in the making of a chief rabbi in early modern Europe.
Right. Okay. A couple more biographical details. Obviously,
Sure.
also wanted to, I guess we should point that as well. The book has a lot of these details throughout it, but the book isn't, like you said, isn't only focused on this. It's focused a lot on the history of books and the stories that books tell, and the whole book trade tells as well, a lot of as well, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So just, I think you told me that your actual dissertation had a little bit more of this biography. And actually, there's another podcast that just came out right now that will address more of that, probably than we will. I'll link to that if people want to hear that. But you mentioned there that originally, when you started even the book, you were going to focus more on the biography. You ended up not going that way. Is there a reason why you decided on that?
I didn't think it was as exciting. I'll even say a little bit differently. So when I wrote my dissertation, it was very detailed about the intricacies of which year Oppenheim moved from this place to that year, which year he took up this position, which year his position was contested, and the list goes on. And I realized that I had a wonderful opportunity when I was living in Oxford. I got to teach a class where I showed people the books. I got to teach 4 2-hour classes where we looked at the books, and I built the whole session around these books. And I realized the thing that everybody got the most excited about was seeing these books, And I realized the thing that I was most excited about was the books. And I decided at that point that I didn't just want to tell the story of a man. I wanted to tell a bibliobiography. I wanted to tell the life story of a library, not the life story of a person. It excited listeners. And I realized that the reason the listeners were excited is because I was more excited about that. And at a certain point, you just have to, when you're telling a story, you have to follow your heart. You have to pick the thing that gets you most excited. The great thing about any life story, this is what, just a couple of hundred pages. There are so many other ways to tell the story. There are so many stories I didn't get to tell, but I picked the things that got me the most excited. And God willing, somebody else will tell more stories about Oppenheim and his library, or maybe just Oppenheim, that will take it in totally different directions. And I'll look
Right.
forward to reading that too.
Right. Okay. But so I guess for here, we'll drop a few more biographical details. I mean, there
Okay.
are obviously a lot in the book. So we mentioned before that he became the chief rabbi of Prague, but he was a co-chief rabbi, so to speak. So what does that mean? And the other one was around Brody. So obviously, we had some disagreements. Maybe speak a little bit about what happened there.
Sure. Okay. Let me start by saying Prague was a tough place when it came to power and politics in the early modern period. First of all, it was a huge, huge Jewish community. In the year 1700, there were over 11,000 Jews in a city of only about 40 to 45,000 people total. It was a real Jewish metropolis. It was the largest urban Jewish community in all of Christian Europe. And it was also a place with a lot of fights. The Prague Kihila had an electoral system that was broken into parties. They had like an actual party system where people would vote for which one would get into power. And they would the parties would so often disagree that eventually the emperor had to step in to broker agreements between them that also involved compromised chief rabbis. And so throughout the 1690s, and then for the first couple of decades of Oppenheim's life, of Oppenheim's time there in Prague, the rabbinate was shared. Oppenheim gets there around 1703, 1704, and he's named the Av Beis Din, but he's not the Rosh Yeshiva or the Resh Mitivta. That position is reserved for Rav Avraham Broda. And the two of them are these co-chief rabbis. This is something that Oppenheim was clearly not too tickled about. In the year 1704, shortly after getting to Prague, he wrote a letter to the scribe of the Jewish community in Krakow and asked them to check their Pinkas Kahal, to check their Jewish community regulations, to ask them, when a community has an Av Beis Din and a Rosh Yeshiva, which one is superior to the other? And to his disappointment, the answer came back: we have no protocol that sets one above the other. But you can tell more from the question than from the answer. Oppenheim was clearly looking for precedent because he was sharing this position. Oppenheim and Broda, we don't have a ton of documents about them, but we know from the documents that survive that the two of them had quite the rivalry. One of the best pieces of evidence from them is the diary, I guess we can call it a diary, of Pinchas Katzenelnbogen called Yesh Menchilin. He tells us that he lived in Prague and studied in both of the yeshivas, and that the Talmidim of, so Oppenheim had a small yeshiva, Broda had a large yeshiva as the Rosh Yeshiva of Prague, and the students clashed all the time. Katzenelnbogen tells us he was the only one, or one of the few, that was able to swim between the two yeshivas, and didn't fight like everybody else. You look like you want to say something.
Wow, no, I was gonna say, I believe one of Avraham Broda's students was a famous, later a very famous rabbi, who also clashed halakhically with David Oppenheim, right? Which is Rabbeinu Sinaivshitz, is that
I'll
correct?
say, boy was he ever! Boy was he ever! It's so. So it's, I think I've got some evidence for this that Oppenheim and Broda were already competitors even before Oppenheim got to Prague. In fact, Broda had already had a difficult career in Prague throughout the 1690s before Oppenheim was even offered a position. And in the year 1700, or maybe it was 1701, the documents aren't fully clear, he traveled away from Prague and went to Poland. And we think it was because he was going to look for a different position. He may well have been just fed up with the Jews of Prague, and especially with the kind of oligarchy that ran the city. It was the Spira Vedelis clan were the ones who really controlled the rabbinate of Prague, and Broda got permission and a kind of passport to travel to Poland to Brisk. But I gotta say, poor guy, because at almost the same time that he was traveling, Oppenheim had been named chief rabbi of Brisk as well. And we know this because Oppenheim wrote a flowery letter to the Kehillah of Brisk and then published a great big broadside to the Kehillah of Brisk to make sure that not only did the recipients of his handwritten letter get the picture, but so would anybody who could see these large printed broadsides. So Broda, I think you can see the rivalry already from there. And it spilled over into all kinds of halachic matters as well. One of the big ones is in 1707, 1708, when a woman arrived, a widow, I should say, arrived in Prague, who had come from Northern Europe. And she thought that she was arriving in Prague in order to remarry. It was a. This is a, it's like a sort of a complicated sugya, but she had shown up there with an infant or a child under 24 months. And so the case kind of triggered the issue of meineke schaveru, with the, there are important and complicated halachas about the heter of a woman who has a child under 24 months to remarry. There's different explanations for this, but this woman, her husband had died. She had three older children, and then an infant under 24 months, and she had got a heter from the Chacham Tzvi to remarry. And she traveled to Prague, and once she got there, Avraham Broda didn't allow it, and this triggered this kind of continent-wide rabbinic controversy. Tshuva's letters poured in from all kinds of places. And ultimately, Broda was bested, and he kind of threw his hands up and left the Prague community and took up the chief rabbinate in Metz, leaving Oppenheim to claim now both halves of this. But exactly as you say, Broda had hundreds, if not more, students, and he also had people who considered themselves his students, even if they never learned directly in his base medrash. And one of them was Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, who years later, decades later, properly decades later, published or tried to vindicate Broda by having conversations with the academics of the Jesuit university. He tells us that he consulted with an academer, is the word that is the way that he writes it, an academer he consulted with and asked about the science. The reason that the case of the Meineke Schaveru worked out is because the woman had had previous children who had died. And so she had had a wet nurse this child instead. And so the Chacham Tzvi and others believed that she should be allowed to remarry because she wasn't technically nursing this child. She had a wet nurse who was doing it instead. And they based that on the idea that her milk was somehow poisonous. And Eibschitz, employing the best of the science of his day, although that science was almost completely out of fashion by the time, consulted with medical academics and asked if it's possible, could it be at all possible for a nursing mother's breast milk to be poisonous? And the academics of the Jesuit university said such a thing is not possible because all the fluids flow through the body. And so if she had poison anywhere in her body, it would have poisoned her as well. And so such a thing is not possible. All of the halachic foundations of all of the heters were mistaken, and Broda was right all along, and Oppenheim was a fraud. And the relationship was a marred one thereafter. Oppenheim and Eibschitz never stopped clashing with each other.
Were they involved in there was the other machlokes with the that was the chicken without a heart, or that wasn't
Yeah,
that was
yep, they were involved in that as well. And then in the 1720s, when Eibschitz is properly installed there, we've got sometimes Eibschitz taunting Oppenheim students, and other times Oppenheim getting involved in some of the campaigns against Eibschitz. Yaakov Emden, as you can probably guess, was a fan of Oppenheim and not of Eibschitz. But all of this is really important because when we read the different accounts, we also have to think critically and carefully. We know that Emden was a polemical guy, as he wrote, and so we can't accept everything that he says as absolute truth as it really was. We have to remember to read it as an argument, not as a neutral report, but as an argument. And so it's a challenge to reconstruct Oppenheim's role in there, because everything that Emden writes is so vitriolic when it comes to Eibschütz, that we also have to think about how he casts the heroes of his story. The enemy of my enemy becomes my friend. And so we need to read sensitively when thinking about these stories.
Right. One last question, then we'll jump into
Sure.
talking about Sabbateanism. What there was a one story where Rav David Oppenheim gave a haskamah to Nechemya Chayon, who was clearly a Sabbatean, and that made a big tumult. What happened there?
Okay, so the way the story goes, and this too should be read with sensitivity. One of the things that I think is so fascinating about Oppenheim, is that he lived in the great age of the heresy hunters. He lived in the age of the anti-Sabbateans, Chachamtzvi not least among them, Chagiz not least amongst them. And yet he kind of managed to maintain ties with both sides of the war. His library was full of Sabbatean material. It had manuscripts that were written by Nathan of Gaza. It had Sabbatean tfilos, and most shocking, it had the Haskamas to Chayon's books. The story, as we're told it, is that Chayon had been passing through Prague and had befriended Oppenheim's son, and had maintained hospitality in Oppenheim's home, possibly while Oppenheim was away from home. Now, this is not an implausible story, because although we've been talking about Oppenheim as chief rabbi of Prague, he spent a significant amount of time away from Prague. And that's because his library was, for most of his life, not in the city of Prague at all. Although it was with him when he lived in Moravia, it never set up camp with him in the city of Prague. Prague had a strong Catholic censorship system. And so when Oppenheim took up the chief rabbinate of Prague, he moved his library to the northern German city of Hanover, where his father-in-law, who was a court Jew, had a large estate. And Oppenheim got the rights of residence to live there, to establish a house there, and to keep his entire library there. And we have lots of letters that were addressed to him, not in Prague, but in Hanover instead, which means people knew if you want to reach Oppenheim, don't write to him in Prague necessarily. You may also want to write to him in Hanover. So it's entirely possible that Oppenheim was out of town when Chaim passed through. And as lots of your listeners will know, most haskamas are given not from a careful and thorough reading of the contents of a text, but are usually given when somebody makes a recommendation about the character of the author. This is certainly the case in the early modern period, that haskamas tend to be about the reputation of the writer, not the book that the writer has written. And so they say, I know him, he seems like a nice guy. Or more importantly, I know somebody who said he was a nice guy, and so I too am adding my haskama as well. They usually say, I've only seen a couple of pages of this, but I hear from my colleagues that this is a good person, and so I contribute to this as well. And so Oppenheim maintained a degree of plausible deniability. He lent his Haskama, and the item was published with his Haskama. I have to say, other books by Chayon were published that republished the Haskama without his consent. But then later, when Oppenheim was confronted by the Chacham Tzvi for doing this, he also didn't retract his Haskama. Instead, he got upset with the Chacham Tzvi for kind of airing the dirty laundry in a public machlokes, which suggests that he was walking a very, very delicate line. That on the one hand, he wasn't a full-blown Sabbatean by any stretch of the imagination, but he may have wanted to preserve at least moderate relations with Sabbateans, possibly because of all the books that they might have been able to contribute to his library. I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Right. Oh, that's very fascinating. Now, a lot of what we just discussed is in the book, the actual book. So people can obviously should read the book and they can check that out there. Now let's start with the library. So you said he had somewhere of, let's say, 4,500 books and 1,000 manuscripts, let's just say, which is a massive number.
Massive.
First of all, a few questions. Where did he get all the money to buy this? Obviously, you said he was wealthy, but is that he personally had so much money to buy all these? His connections that he had for this, and then I guess third of all, kind of together, is did he have a particular taste in Sfarim and books, or was it just get me everything? I want to collect everything.
Great question. It's a great, those are both wonderful questions. So the first, where did he have the money for them? There are two counts to that. The first and the more important answer is that the family wealth has to have been the thing that fueled the collecting activities and maintained those collecting activities. And it was accumulating family wealth. First, it was his own parents and uncles. Then, through marriage to his first wife, who was from a wealthy Frankfurt family, and then after she passed away, to his second wife, who was from the wealthy family of the court Jew of Hanover. In each of these cases, they were very careful marriage strategies that maintained a network of learning on the one hand and wealth on the other to produce this kind of leadership cohort. And so the family wealth on all sides was just exorbitant. It didn't last forever. In fact, it barely lasted through his children's generation. But for his lifetime, it appears to have been not only enough, but more than enough to afford any book that his heart desired. But I should also say that there are less material ways the books got into his collection. And that is because he was a powerful man, people knew that they could benefit from being in his good graces by giving him gifts. And sometimes some of the most beautiful and precious items in the collection appear to be gifts to Oppenheim that came from people who wanted to please him. They're really cute is probably the word from the cute manuscripts of different Masechtas of the Gemara that are like the size of a passport, barely bigger than a phone, that often say this is a gift to Oppenheim. There was a whole group of emissaries from Eretz Yisrael who were hoping that Oppenheim would get his relatives to give tzedakah to the small Ashkenazic Jewish community of Jerusalem, who would send him amazing manuscripts. And I assume that he probably did not pay for those directly, but instead, those manuscripts were meant to be a kind of gift that would encourage him to get his family to give tzedakah instead. So the lion's share of what he did certainly came from family money, but the gifts as well. And sometimes his family money or his personal and family money was expected to help Jews in other locations. When that Krakow exchange happened in the year 1704, when he writes to Krakow to say, "What do we do? Who's the real chief rabbi, me or Broda?" The answer comes back also to say, "We need more Gemaras. Can you send us Gemaras, please?" Or in the year 1705, when a new publication of the Chumash came out, the printer, a Christian printer, corresponded with Oppenheim and had him buy on consignment 50 copies of the Torah that would pay for part of the, would defray part of the cost of the Chumash to be printed. So Oppenheim would sometimes buy in bulk and distribute, and sometimes he would get as gifts. And so there's sort of a meeting of the two.
Now, sorry, the end of the question, which I want to know, was did he have a particular taste in Sfarim manuscripts, or was just everything that he wanted?
Okay. So there's a couple of answers to that. I think on a fundamental level, Oppenheim ideally wanted to get his hands on every Jewish book that he could. I think that he wanted really to create a kind of universal Jewish library. And certainly we see books that are in Judeo-Arabic, and we see books that are printed in the Ottoman Empire, books that are printed in Italy, and books that are copied in the Eastern Mediterranean. That being said, the books that he most often had access to, and I suspect the ones that were closest to his heart, were the ones from the Ashkenazic world. I think he started to collect first and foremost items that had to do with his hometown of Worms. And from there, even as his collection grew out, I think that was always nearest and dearest to his heart. Part of the reason that I think that is sometimes when he would get items that were written, so manuscripts, not books, but manuscripts that were written out in Sephardic handwriting, he would get somebody to transcribe those into Ashkenazic handwriting. You and your listeners will probably know that there were particular Ashkenazic and Sephardic styles of handwriting. It wasn't just idiosyncratic. Every person had their own style. There was a kind of paleography, a kind of style of handwriting that was different in the Ashkenazic and Sephardic worlds. And in Oppenheim's collection, we have a lot of duplicates of him buying the Sephardic manuscript, and then a copy is made for him in Ashkenazic. We even have a letter that comes to him from around the year 1706, where somebody says, "I've got a manuscript for you, but it's going to take a little bit of time before you get it because we're copying it from the Sephardic into the Ashkenazic hand because we know that's the one you like better." The Welt knew that that's what Oppenheim liked, but still, you can dive into the collection and you can find Purim stuff from Italy. Like, one of the best ways to get a grip on the global reach of this, I find, is to look at the large collections of Tfilos there, because that's really where you get a sense of all kinds of geographic diversity, and you can find Minhagim from around the Jewish world, but still, the lion's share is the Ashkenazic.
Interesting. What would you say is your favorite book in the collection?
Oh, such an unfair question.
No, I know. It could be none.
Okay, so here's how I'm going to dodge. It's a very good question, but I don't know how to answer it. So here's how I'm going to dodge it instead. My favorite book in the collection is not, strictly speaking, a book at all. It's Oppenheim's first catalog. My favorite thing in the collection, it's MS Op 699, and it is this notebook in which Oppenheim wrote out first alphabetically and then afterwards the prices that he paid and the people that he got all of these books from. And I like, this is my favorite item. So it's, you may not call it, it's not really, it's definitely not a sefer, and it's not even a book, but it's my favorite item in this collection because it shows the life of the library is alive there. It shows his mission to do Sfarim ad in kets. Is the expression that he uses. And so it's my absolute favorite item. I basically dedicated the whole first chapter of the book to thinking through that item there because it is just, you could spend a lifetime just enjoying yourself and saying, oh, this is what he had already by 1686. He had this book. And the ink, the color of the ink changes. Sometimes it's darker, sometimes it's lighter. You can see it developing over time as his collection grows and grows.
Wow, that is really fascinating.
That's my favorite.
Okay, now another question that you may not like is obviously things in the collection or a lot of manuscripts are constantly published and used in publications, but obviously a lot of stuff that still aren't. So what is something in the collection that you know of that you would say, okay, I wish somebody would publish this?
Oh, what do I wish was published? More stuff
If there's
dealing.
something that you know of in the collection that isn't published, yeah, I mean,
I would love to see people publish more stuff about the plague.
well, there is. Well, we'll get to. We'll get to that to wrap up. So let me jump into another thing here for everyone is that he obviously wrote a lot as well, and
Yes.
nothing was ever published and is published today. I mean, I have a few Sfarim here on my desk that are published today. I'll just list them all for you. There's obviously two of us from him, Nichshol David, which was published. There's a new edition. You can't get it anymore. So yeah, forget about it. There was two Sfarim, Yad David and Shem David al Haterah, printed. It's a bit of a mangled edition, whatever. We can talk about what they did. Then there was Zichron Aharon printed, Pirkei Shira and Perek Shira with his Pirush. And also, I just emailed you earlier today, Yad David al Haterah from Machon Stalin Karlin, which I wanted to ask you about. Let's for a second. I know this is like sidetracking. That says that the Stalin Rebbe Nachshol is from his collection, and he has something else in the Yalkut of it. He owns manuscripts from Oppenheim. Does that make sense? How does he own that?
So great. This is actually the question actually fits nicely with what you've been leading us up to, because your point is very well taken. Very few, in fact, virtually nothing that Oppenheim wrote was printed. What did he write that was printed the most? Haskamas to books. Haskamas and Other Svarim is the thing. If you want to see Oppenheim printed, the place to look for him is Haskamas to Other People's Svarim, but almost not his own. But I do want to push back just a little bit, because you've given us a list of the Svarim that he's written. And in fact, there's more, right? There's Moed David, there's Sukkos David, and these are all titles that he gave his Svarim. It's true that none of his stuff, or virtually none of his stuff, was printed during his lifetime. But they were still books. They existed in multiple copies, even though they were in manuscript copy. And so it is not entirely surprising that there are multiple manuscript copies of these items, because Oppenheim was regularly, he always had his eye on the idea of publishing his material. He had his Talmidim copy stuff for him. And he was an inveterate reviser. He was constantly editing and editing and editing and revising his material. So there are multiple editions of Moed David in the Bodleian right now, but there are also manuscript editions in the National Library of Israel. There's one in Sifriat Rambam in Tel Aviv. And so it's not fully surprising that there are manuscript copies of this floating around. And this is important on two counts. It's true that Oppenheim is not largely part of the halachic discourse because his books weren't published. But in his lifetime, people seem to have had copies of the Svarim that he'd written in manuscript form. And in the world that he lived in, books and manuscripts lived side by side. You could read something out of a printed sefer, you could read something out of a manuscript. It wasn't hidden behind the glass walls of a rare book and manuscript library, although I value those very, very deeply. Thank God for the people who protect and preserve those books. But for somebody's, you know, halachic full picture, they could consult a book or a manuscript as long as they got the information out of it. And so in his lifetime, that kind of material seems to have been partially accessible. And so it doesn't totally surprise me to hear that there are manuscript copies of his Svarim in different places.
Right. So like I said, one of those, long story short, the Yad David from Stalin, it kept his exact Lushan that he wrote it in. The other ones, whatever. Read what they wrote that they did there and decide if anyone wants to buy it on their own. I don't know what they did.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I'm even yelling.
Yeah, exactly. I'm even yelling. So, to close up the book and then to discuss what you mentioned, your current project, just to wrap up over here, what's something that you didn't address in your book that you wish you could have addressed in the book?
Oh, good question. One of the big things, what I had initially paid a lot more attention to the halachic controversies. And those, I cover them only somewhat fleetingly in the book. I would have loved to have continued to think about them. I was really, when I was thinking about Oppenheim, I was really interested and excited in particular about the kind of boundaries of halachic communities. And like the way they were sometimes really real geographic communities. I really would have loved to have had more of that in the book. And it's a question that I still think about a lot, especially when you get your hands on real letters. So not printed tshuvas, but instead like the real letters that contain only the question or only the answer, you start to get a sense of who was talking to who and who gets left out of the equation and who gets brought into it. And I talk about this a little bit in the book, but I would have loved to have explored it so much further in it. And so there's room. I hope maybe somebody else would like to do that before I get a chance to. That would be very okay too. but it's something that I certainly wish I had had more of a chance to work through in the book. But publishers are very strict about how many words and how many pages a book can be.
Right. So obviously, I'll link to the book after over here, and that definitely a must read. And there's a lot of other, like we said, book theory, book history that we really haven't gotten to here. But yeah, there's another podcast you did that I can link to if people want to listen.
There's one other amazing story. I mean, I'll give you just the headlines of it. Oppenheim's wife went to court at one point. She was put on trial. And I would love, to this day, I would still love to spend more time. Perhaps my great regret from the book is that I didn't get to give this any attention. I just couldn't make it a part of the larger argument and story. And I think it sort of speaks to the different Jewish political parties in Prague at the time. It's a story I'd still like to tell.
Is it in the book at all, or is not no mention of it?
Not, I couldn't squeeze a mention of it in. It just felt like it would be a drop-in rather than meaningful. And but it is also my great regret to this day. And now it's recorded. Now everybody knows.
So two things. Is it in your dissertation? And do you want to tell the story now, or you don't want to say the story?
It's a little too convoluted to tell the story, so I'll leave it as just a teaser, and I promise to do something with
It's in your dissertation, though?
it.
Okay, well we'll have to badge you about it to write something up on it or something. Now
That
that
would
you've
be very
told.
helpful to me. That would be very helpful.
Yeah. Okay, so let's finish off something you mentioned earlier, something you said you would have wished would have been published on the plague. Your current research is actually focused on the plague, which is unfortunately apropos right now. So why don't you tell us about what exactly it is that you're working on, how you got there?
Sure. Okay. So Oppenheim led me to the plague. As you and your listeners know, there's no shortage. You can almost get overwhelmed by all of the material that's coming out about the plague these days. I followed Oppenheim into the plague, or rather, I followed Oppenheim away from the plague a couple of years ago. Your readers or your listeners will hear that one of the stories that I work through in the book is a kind of sensational trial where Oppenheim is accused on account of having the title Nasi Eretz Yisrael, Prince of the Land of Israel. He's accused by the coffee house operator in Prague of this. And so when I was researching the story, I was trying to unfold all of the details back and forth of how this works. And at one point, there's a detail in the story of them wrestling with each other, is that Oppenheim is out away from Prague. But he's not in Hanover, it doesn't seem. It seems like he is in Vienna. And the reason he's away is because plague has hit the city of Prague. And I thought this was quite remarkable. What's he doing running away from the city? I never really thought about plague very much before. Nowadays, we think about plague all too much, and many of us are probably familiar with the sugyas and the really kind of long material about whether or not it's mutter to run away from a city during a time of plague or not. And that kind of got me interested and excited in thinking about how Jews experienced plague. I didn't want to tell the big and sensational stories of the Black Death, the kind of famous or infamous, I should say, massacres of the Jews in the Black Death. I wanted to understand how in the years afterwards, what happens in moments of crisis like this? How do they cope? How do they fare? Are they accused? Are they not accused? Are they creative in different ways? How does the community respond? And I found just wonderful material all relating to one plague year in Prague, in the year 1713. And so I'm trying to write a book now that's going to tell the story of 6 months of plague, but use it to also think about other experiences of Jews and plague in the long early modern period. And also the wider history of Jews in the city of Prague, at the same time.
Wow, fascinating. I'll definitely be looking forward to that as well.
I didn't
So
think it was going to be so relevant. I wish it wasn't so relevant.
now, so that you almost it's almost it's very unfortunate. Obviously, we all wish this wouldn't have happened, but currently it's going to be like, okay, that's going to be like everyone's be looking forward to the book. We want to read on that. It's relevant.
I will say it's comforting. In some ways, to me, it's very comforting. These are hard times we're living in. Whether people who are listening are, staying at home with families, are at home by themselves, are working at home or are out of work, are aching to get out or worried about leaving. We're living in really complicated and difficult times. And I have to say it's comforting to dive into the past and to see that even though this moment feels unprecedented, that people have experienced hardships like this and also come out the other side. Not always. These are stories of tremendous loss as well, but it offers a measure of perspective. And even just knowing that this is not unprecedented can sometimes be a very comforting thing.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. It was really great chatting with you.
Likewise. Take care. Have a good night.
Thank you. Good night.